there any sound? Hello, one testing, 1, 2, 3, yeah. Okay. Let's start. So we're back in IMT 4116, reverse engineering and malware analysis, and we're going to try to cover two chapters today, chapter 11 and 12. Most of the time will be spent in 11, as 12 is not that long. Just first an introduction to part 4 in the book. So we've now had basic static, basic dynamic, and we had advanced static and advanced dynamic, and now we're in part 4, and it's about malware functionality. Last time when we had stealthy and anonymous analysis, I covered part of chapter 14, and then we'll try to go through 11 and 12 today, and I'll see if I can cover chapter 13 in one of the lectures later. I need to look at this as we're running out of time and we can't cover the whole book, so I need to prioritize a little bit. But today we're going through chapter 11, malware behavior. This chapter is about trying to characterize code that is malicious, or what characterizes the code that is malicious, and trying to provide information that that relates to the behavior of malicious code. So we'll go through this step by step. First topic the book takes up is downloaders and launchers. Downloaders, then the name is pretty much self-explanatory. This is when the malware that you get on your computer goes on the internet and downloads another piece of malware. So the first part is just enables that download, and then when it's downloaded, it executes it on the local system. Sometimes then it's combined with exploits. So maybe it needs to escalate the privileges, or maybe it needs to escape the sandbox, or something like that. That could then be part of the downloader. Commonly used. See if I can keep the. There it is. Mouse over here. Commonly used Windows APIs for this is URL download to file. To get the file down, and another thing to look for is WinExec to execute the file. There are other ways of doing it, but these two might be worth looking for. Then we have launchers, which then installs the malware and executes it either immediately or under certain conditions in the future. And then of the malware is often contained in the malware. An example of this you've already seen in the assignment number one. A little bit more about this in chapter 12. We'll get back to that. So that was downloaders and launchers. Then next topic is backdoor. And here we go back to the kill chain and the command and control step number 6. The backdoor provides remote access to the victim's machine. And this is a most common type of malware. A lot of malware needs this. And if you provide a backdoor for the malware, then you have a full set of capabilities. You have the ability to do pretty much what you want. You can manipulate registry keys, enumerate the display windows, so try to see what the victim is looking at. You also can create directories, search files, you name it. Take pictures with the camera, take sound from the microphone, anything you want. The different functionalities that implements this, you should look at Appendix A and see what's used to implement the different things. Backdoors also provides the remote access in numerous ways, but HTTP over port 80 is very common, and there's a good reason for this. The malware writer wants to blend in with normal traffic. They don't want to make it too easy for us. Reverse shell. That's a connection that originate from the infected machine and provide shell access. And then if you get this up, you can execute commands as if you were on the local machine. And again, this can be simple standalone malware, or this can be this functionality can be part of a bigger malware suit, so part of sophisticated backdoor malware. Netcat reverse shell. We touched a little bit on Netcat in chapter 3. This is known to be used in malware. And on the on the attacker's machine, you write this command. L is then for listening mode, and P is the port number you want to use, in this case 80. And on the victim machine, you then need to get this command executed, netcat listener, and the IP address, or the netcat listener IP address, and then port 80. And then what program you want to execute. So this will be the listener IP 80 is then important there. That's the IP address and port of the remote machine. So it connects back to this. And then in this case, you want to run the command shell. And you also have Windows reverse shell with two implementations, basic or multi-thread. The basic use then create process, and it manipulates the startup information that is passed to create process, and then you create a socket to the remote machine, and you set the standard input and output for an error for handling for the application, in this case cmd.exe, to that given socket. This will run then the command line with as a new process with the manipulated information, and this, if you go back, this is the example that you saw in chapter 7, example 7.4 on page 148. So go back and have a look at that. That's an example of how to implement reverse shell, Windows reverse shell with the basic setup. There's a multi-thread variation where you create sockets, two pipes, and two threads. What you need to look for then is the create thread and create pipe functions. And after the create process, you see the create process, you will see two different threads start up. One that reads from the standard in pipe and writes to the socket, and one that reads the socket and writes to standard out pipe. And it's very common that these threads manipulate the data or encode the data. So that was reverse shell, netcat, or basic or multi-thread Windows reverse shell. Then there's term that you might have heard, remote administration tool, or RAT. Just first to comment on a common mistake, and I do this myself, because RAT is one of those things you just say RAT and then you forget what it stands for. So a lot of people will say remote access tool, because that's what it's used for. And I do this myself, but yeah, remote administration tool is what it's supposed to be. This is used to remotely manage computers, so this is a legitimate tool. But of course, as with many other tools, if you have a legitimate use, you also have a malicious use. So this is often used in targeted attacks. And one example is Poison Ivy. Poison Ivy's client-server setup. Well, the client is the remote command and control unit that controls a set of servers, and these servers are then the infected victim units. And these will beacon to the client to start communication. if you don't know what beacon is, that's just a periodic signal that it sends out to see if there's a response from the other end. And if you see signals that go out from a computer in regular intervals, at least I would check if this was a beacon signal, at least if it's on a channel that you're shouldn't be there. But as you see below, they commonly use ports that should have traffic, but looking for regular traffic here might be smart. So Poison Ivy uses either port 80 or 443 to communicate with the service. And once, if the client decides to issue new commands, you just wait for the service to beacon in, and then establish the connection, and you can do whatever your fantasy limits. So that was remote administration tools, not remote access tools, RATs. Another functionality or that malware tried to accomplish is botnets. Just a collection of compromised hosts, also known as zombies, controlled by a botnet controller. And in this case, it's non-targeted. The idea for the malware writers here is just to get hold of as many hosts as possible. The more, the better. And what do they use it for? The best known is probably denial of service attacks, but it's also used to spread spam and also to spread additional malware. A couple of key differences between RAT and botnet. Botnets are typically large, and we're talking millions. And RATs typically control less. And that's if you picture that botnets are non-targeted and RATs are usually targeted and more sophisticated malware, this makes sense. Try to hit as many as possible. Selected targets, so that makes sense that they control less. Botnets, you have one controller that controls many, so you issue the same command to a lot of zombies. But RATs, since it's targeted, you focus on one target at a time. So you sit there and you control one computer, and then you go to the next and you control that one. Yeah, and I cover the two last points there: RAT targeted attacks, botnets, mass attacks, i.e. a specific web page or, yeah. What else do malware do? Let's look at credential stealers. Just a few words here. This is, it's always been, the cyber criminals always go for where they can make money. And when you think of passwords, credit card information, it's obvious that you can make money on that. But some years ago, we saw that they started collecting more information than we thought they needed for making money. And then, of course, you can speculate, why do they do this? Do they just collect as much as they want, or just in case? Or do they have, or can they make money on other information that we didn't think about? Well, that's a diversion. Now we're going to look at different ways of doing this. Three types. You could wait for the user to log in and then try to steal the credential as this happens. You can dump stored information, let's say the hash of the passwords, or you could, of course, log the keystrokes as they happen. I'm going to go through a couple of different ways to implement this. The book mentions Gina interception. Remember that this book is based on XP, so in Vista and later, this is no longer in use, but I think anyway it serves as a good example just to show how the malware writers think. Windows XP has a graphical identification and authentication unit called Gina that allows third parties to customize basically the logon process. And the example mentioned in the book is if you want to add RFID or smart cards to your login process, then Gina will facilitate this for third parties. But this can, of course, be exploited, and the malware writers then inserts this one, the DLL here, in between the logon and the next step. So if you, one thing that you should keep in mind, if Microsoft or somebody provides some functionality for third parties to make it easier for them to develop some new software, that you could be sure that people would try to exploit it as well. Hash dumping. It's passwords are really popular and understandably so to get a hand on. So hash dumping is used then to steal the hashes of the password to either crack them offline where you have more resources, or to use the pass the hash attack. There are protocols where it's enough to just know the hash, and then you can use that, and you get the legal protocol up. Two things we that is important to at least understand is the or two terms that you should know about is the LM hash and the NTLM hash. The LM stands for Lawn Manager Hash. Excuse me. This is an. I'm not sure if this is used anymore. It might be there for backward compatibility. So I'm going to mention it just in case. If you have your password stored according to the LM hash, today that is equivalent to having them as clear text. There are rainbow tables that will do this in no time. And at least it used to be that password that are less than 14 characters were stored at this. So if you wanted to avoid having your hash stored in this format, you needed a password that was greater than 14 character, or you had to use non-ASCII characters. But if you look in 2012 and look up Mike Pilkington, he did some work on that. Even though you had a long password and you thought that the hash was not generated, it was still found in memory, so you were able to get around this anyway. I'm hoping this is better today, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's not. It's amazing how much old code is kept in the background for, yeah, good or non-good reasons. So the next step was then the NTLM hash, which is widely deployed and now used for kept for compatibility. This is also weak and can be brute forced. And after NTLM, it's Kerberos that is implemented, but the NTLM is still used for, at least what I could find out, log on authentication and standalone systems. You can read more about this if you look up in Microsoft MSDN, same place that you look for functions if you need that. Message here is that passwords are stored as hashes with different techniques that have a varying degree of strengths. If you have a system with LM, you're pretty much giving up your passwords. NTLM hash is also not that good. Hopefully Kerberos is better, and the question is then, can the attacker get access to these even if this is the preferred choice? Okay, that's a little bit about how the hashes are stored, and then it's how to get the hash. Two popular tools is pvdump and pass the hash, or PSH toolkit. These are open source, so the code is available for anyone who wants to write malware. The first version is of course detected by antivirus, but the malware writers will then use the open source code, tweak it, and try to compile it in a way that is not detected by these systems. And the example I will go through in the book is then a derived version of these that are found in the wild. First one, pvdump. Pvdump is a set of programs, and if they're available, they're looking for the LM and the NTLM password hashes. They retrieve it from something called Security Account Manager, and they do it by using DLL injection. And we'll talk more about that later, what it is. DLL injection inside something called Local Security Authority Subsystem Services, or the LSASS .exe. So this file here is often the target. And if you get access there, then it's... Or you need the right privileges to get in here. But if you do that, then you have access to this, and then you can dump the hashes. What they the example I'm going to show now, they injected a DLL LSA EXT into this file, and they had a standard export get hash that is easily changed, so it might not be named get hash in other versions. But what you should look for here is the function get proc address to detect attempts like this. Try to walk you through one of the example from the book. I can't move over there. I'm out of the picture, so I'll use the see if I can get the mouse there again. What you can see here is that why did it disappear? Oh, there we go. That this this PV dump variant that we can see here uses some unique API calls. You see SAM SRV, you see SAM iConnect, and a couple more down there that is begins with SAM. First you do is to get a handle to the library, the SAM SRV DLL, so that gives you easier access to the to SAM. Then they look for ADV API 32, and hopefully from assignment one or an earlier, you know that if you get that, you can resolve functions not already imported. So now we're targeting lsass.exe. So if you need functions that are not already loaded, then you need this ADV API DLL. Then load library, you get the handle to the library. And some way down here, you get SAM IGET private data, that is to get the hashes. And there are also two system functions, 025 and 027, that is used to decrypt the hashes. How do you, what should trigger your curiosity here is the number of get proc addresses, because it needs a lot of functions that are not already imported. And also the APIs that I use are special. You won't find them normally. None of the functions that are used here are documented by Microsoft. I haven't checked, but if you go under MSDN, you can see if you find any of them up there. But that should be, if not a red flag, at least a flag that you should look closer to this. If you see it imports a bunch of functions that are not documented, then something might be going on. All right, I see we have might have one follower online, so Skype questions if you have any. And you two are all right? Yep. So that was the PV dump. The PSH toolkit, pass the hash toolkit, then contains programs that dump hashes. One that is called who's there dash alt is the most popular. It dumps SAM. It also uses DLL injection into lsass.exe. But it uses completely different APIs than pvdump. So it tries to do the same, but if you detect those other API calls, then you can think pvdump. And if you want to detect this one, it's a little different. So what are the unique API calls for who's there alt? Well, let's look at least one variation, because as with PVDump, this is also open source. They take this and they alter it and try not to be obvious about what they do. What they do here is that first they dynamically load the secure or CUR32 DLL, and they resolve the LSA enumerate log on sessions function. And this is used, as I've written on here, used to get local unique identifiers, such as usernames and domains for each time, for each log on the system. And then you can use the, down here, use API call NLP get primary credentials to dump the LM and NT LM hashes. There's also this DLL MSV10DLL involved. So these are, again, detecting this, look for these API calls and study it closer. And then it's we need to take a step back, because yes, it's important to recognize that the that the hashes were dumped, and it would be nice to distinguish between the two techniques. But it's much more critical to analyze and find out what did the malware actually do with the hashes. Were they stored on disk? Were they sent out of your system to a web page? Or were they used in past the hash attacks? Because this will determine, let's say they're stored on disk and you have no indication communication going out, then you know that yes, they took them, but they haven't done anything with them yet. If they're already out on the web, then you can consider them lost. And if they were used here, then they probably got access to something else. And what was that? So the first thing here is to determine the overall functionality, and then you can go to the low-level hash dumping method. And this doesn't apply only to this case. This applies with all malware analysis. Get the big picture first, and don't get lost in the details until you see the big picture. Yeah, you should have heard that before. So I'll mention it many. I'll probably mention it again. It's so important. It's some people love to analyze assembly code and get lost in the little details down in a corner of the malware, and they don't see the big picture, and that's interesting but not very productive. Let's see, still 10 minutes. Okay, back to, so that was credential stealers trying to get hold of the password hashes. We mentioned keyloggers. So you can read the keystrokes. What can you use that for? Username, password, basically anything you type. Two types, kernel-based and user space keyloggers. Kernel-based will be more difficult to detect. And they are often part of rootkits. You don't detect this with the applications that you use in user mode. If you go back to, I think it was chapter 10 with Sergey, he gave you maybe an indication of how to look beyond the user mode. And that's not really the main focus of this course, but know that it's there. They can act as drivers and bypass protections and apps that you run in user mode. But there are user space keyloggers also, and they typically use the API functions that are available in Windows, and two different types, hooking and polling. The hooking version often uses the set Windows hook EX, and then it gets a notification each time a key is pressed. So a key is pressed, the signal goes off to whatever malware they have installed and say, hey, key was pressed, do you want to know what it is? And it's recorded. A little bit more about it in chapter 12, not much, but a little bit. Or you can do it by pulling. Then you use get async key state. And this function then identifies if a key is pressed or not. And that's combined with another function, get foreground windows, because then you first you determine what's the window that the user is looking at, and then you look for the keystrokes in that window. So here's the typical structure. There we go, there's mouse. So you start at the top here. You call the get foreground windows. And you find out what is the user currently looking at. And then you go into an inner loop here where you call the get async key state, and you check things like, do we have the is the shift key pressed? Is the caps lock on? And then you log it if there's a new key that is pressed. And then you repeat this loop through all possible keys on the keyboard. So you go to next if you're not done with all, and you keep this loop until you've gone through all keys. And then if you're done with all, then you go up and see here, they're still in the same window. And yes, this process is quick enough to keep up with typing. So it's not a slow process. You cannot type many letters within this loop. It will catch individual keystrokes. But of course, to have this running all the time, it might give the user indications that something's going on. And the more often you use malware, the larger the chances are you detect it. So it might go to sleep and only start up under special circumstances, let's say when somebody logs in. Bjørg had a question online. Let's stop and see what he wants. What's stopping malware from implementing its own code and avoid Windows API? Absolutely nothing, Bjørge. Only the skill level of the malware writers. But using Windows APIs it's convenient. Windows has used a lot of time creating these API. Why should you make your own? You could use two arguments. You can make your own to be more efficient, but maybe using Windows API can be argued that makes you blend in more than if you write your own. Yes, you're onto it yourself. Avoid detection, Bjørge mentioned here. It's twofold. Avoid detection, that's very good. So if you use Windows APIs that are not commonly used, yes, you can be detected that way. If you create your own, maybe if you're not careful, they might stick out even more. If you really want to be stealthy, then start reading about rootkits. That's where you have your stealth. Good question. Let's see, a couple of minutes still, okay? All right, so keyloggers, typical structure for the pulling version. This is what it looks in assembly, so this is what you need to memorize all the details. No. But you should be able to look at the assembly code like this and recognize the structure. Let's see if I can get there. You recognize the get foreground windows call. So what is the user actually looking at right now? Okay, I'm going to smash this computer now if that mouse doesn't stick up there for longer than 2 seconds. Then the inner loop starts here. And then you have this call, which checks the status of the shift key. I've written stateless, and I'm coming down here to stateful. I don't know if you're familiar with those terms, and I'm hoping I'm using them correctly. What I mean by that is stateless, it doesn't remember the result from previously. So this is a one-time check. Here is an index. It indexes an array for all the keys. It uses EBX to index this array, and that is to go through all the keys. Then it uses the get async key state. That is the key, the status of the current key that you're checking, because you're checking one at a time. And here goes the mouse again. There you go. And this is stateful. What I mean by that is that it remembers, this function is able to compare previous values. So if it was not pressed before and it is pressed now, then it remembers that. There you go. Further down, it checks the status of the caps lock. And then it down here, it adds 4. That means you check the next, go to the next key. And then it compares EBX to 368. And then it's, if you take 368 divided by 4, 4 bytes per key, you get 92 keys. So this function will go through 92 keys before it goes out of this inner loop. So look for get foreground window, get key state, get async key state, and you're probably dealing with a key logger. And then the question is it malicious or not? Last slide before we take a break. You can also identify keyloggers by looking at the strings list or the imported API function. So you don't have to go right into the assembly details to find keyloggers. When you start with basic static analysis and you list the API functions, and you look at the strings, you might reveal keyloggers already. And if the keylogger wants to log key all keystrokes, then it needs strings that relates to these keys down here: up, num lock, down, right, up, left, page num, so forth. So if you see this, then at least you have an indication that you should look for a keylogger, get confirmation somewhere else. All right, I went overtime last lecture, so I'll stop 2 minutes early this time, pay you back a little bit. We'll continue quarter past 9, unless there are any questions. No, Björk is happy too. Lots of smiley faces, so yeah. Okay, see you in 15 minutes. Okay, then we're back and we'll continue. Talk about the persistence mechanisms, how the malware achieves that. These mechanisms may be a good signature, so if you find this, then considering including that in your signatures. The book looks at three different areas where you can achieve this. You could modify the system's registry. I think we saw that in assignment one, and we mentioned that earlier. We're also going to look at trojanizing binaries and DLL load order hijacking. So the Windows registry, we covered this a bit before, and of course the most popular one is listed on top there, where you find in the current version run that lists the applications that start when you turn the computer on. But there are many other registers that can be used to create persistence, and there are too many to list here, so use tools like auto runs by sysinternals, or use process monitor or the regshot to monitor the modifications. And if you see a register that being modified, that then think, why is this happening, and look into that. So let's look. Go on and look at the app init DLLs, win logon, and SVC host DLLs. App init DLLs. That's loaded into if your process use the user 32 DLL, then you also get this, and you can achieve persistence by changing the key mentioned here. Win logon notify. You can hook malware to a particular logon event. So, say logon, log off, startup, shutdown, or lock screen. And when this win logon.exe generates an event, then it will check something called the notify register key for a DLL that handles that instance, and if you manipulate that, you can also achieve persistence. And finally, the last one mentioned in the book is the SVC host DLLs, and then the malware can try to install as an SVC host exe. And the thing here is that this, if you look at the what's running on your computer, you will see this a lot of instances with that's called SVC host.exe. This is a great way of hiding. But if you even though it's a great way to hide, there's this arms race is also such that if you create a whole new SVC host, then it's easier to detect. So what they do is instead they include themselves in one that's supposed to be there, maybe by adding or overriding something that isn't vital for the system. Detection. Dynamic analysis, look at the changes in Windows registry, or look for the create service API. So that was go back. That was modifying systems registry, and then next one is trojanizing binaries. Persistence can also be achieved by patching a binary that you know is used frequently. So when the system is turned on, you want to you want to get into something that you know is or is very highly likely that is started up. And then you overwrite. You can overwrite some non-critical code in the beginning, and then jump to wherever you put the malware. If there are empty sections in the code, then you get a jump in there. You jump to the code that you want executed, and then you return. And the return is important. You see that in examples later too. That you can't just jump somewhere and start executing whatever you want and forget the real reason this code was executed, because then the user will see that, hey, this didn't work, and be suspicious. And in the book, there's a short example. You have an entry point here, and there's supposed to be a lot of code, but instead it's changed to a jump instruction. Don't know where it goes, but executes something else. This is also mentioned in the book, and just be aware, again, this is XP specific, so I'm not sure if it's still this way in other operating systems, but at least in XP, the loading DLLs follows a very specific order, unless your DLL is part of what is called known DLLs registry. Then that's a way of getting around that specific order, and that order is, by the way, mentioned in the book. But this known DLL registry is a short list, so only the most frequently used DLLs are put there. So if you, the idea here is to insert a malicious DLL and have that be loaded before the actual DLL that is needed. And what you can do is exploit this fact that the / Windows directory is checked before the System32 directory when you're looking for a specific DLL. Just as an example, jump a little back and forth here, Internet Explorer had or have, I'm not sure what I should say since this is XP related, over 50 vulnerable DLLs, and that is DLLs that are found in the System32 directory, for example this one, NTSHRUI. If you instead put a DLL that you created with the same name and put it in the Windows directory, the system will load this before it gets to this legitimate one. And that's what this is all about. You exploit, or you can replace any DLL that's in the System32 and is not part of this known DLL register, and put your malicious DLL then in the Windows directory, and it's loaded. And again, just remember to load the real DLL afterwards so it doesn't crash. Or you're not supposed to remember that, because you're not going to write malware, but that's what the malware writers do. Remember your ethical thinking here. All right. I could give you homework and find out if this is still applicable for current operating systems, but I won't. I just, if you're going to work with this, you've seen it for XP, then it's your job to find out, is this still applicable? And if it's not, then this is still a good example of how malware writers are thinking. Okay, next topic, privilege escalation. Most of us, when we work on computers, run as local administrators. And that means that if you have malware that takes over your computer or your program, you give the malware the same privileges. but sometimes the malware wants higher privileges, and use than either known exploits or 0 days against the operating system to achieve this. And there's a framework, Metasploit, that is really good at this and has a lot of these vulnerabilities built in and use them to escalate the privileges to get more access to, or give the malware the access it needs. And here also DLL load order hijacking can be used to achieve this. There's an example in the book. I'm not going to go through it. And again, it's a little bit like the hash. You can look at it, but it is more important to find out what did the malware do with this increased access. But this can serve as a step one. It says, hey, the malware is increasing its privileges. Why? That's a good question. The book is also covering a little bit about user mode rootkits. It says that it's the most common tool used to hide malicious activity, or rootkit is. I have given in Blackboard, there's a list of books that is recommended reading if you want to learn more. And there's one book that I think is called The Rootkit Arsenal. If you want to study rootkits, then that I would recommend that book. Very briefly, rootkits modify how the OS works. There are user space and kernel space, and there are two techniques mentioned in the book. IAT hooking. This technique works by modifying pointers. When you load a program, you have an import address table or an export address table that actually shows where in memory your functions are to be found. So when you import the DLLs, they are put in memory somewhere, and these tables tell you where that is. So if you modify that those pointers, you can get that to point to malicious code instead. Different technique, inline hooking, then you change the content, then you overwrite the function code, and you can do that either to damage, or you can do it to change to a code that you you'd like, or very simple, like we already covered, just add a jump instruction and put the malicious code somewhere else. And what I've told many times now, going a little bit too fast. This inline hooking is then executed after the DLL is imported. What I was going to say is that remember when you jump to a malicious code that you also jump back and give the so the systems don't crash. Example in the book. A process wants to terminate a program. This can be done by using the API call terminate process found in kernel 32. The import address table knows the memory location of that function. So when the program calls terminate process, it's supposed to go in here, in the import address table, find the memory location of terminate process, go there in the kernel 32 DLL, and perform whatever that code needs to do. But the IAT hooking will then reroute that call not up here but down to a version that the malware has created, and with a different so we go down here instead. There's a different address here that takes us to the rootkit or the malicious code before we then return to the code that is executed. And this example in the book actually does something here so that this terminate process up here won't work. It will execute, but it won't actually kill the process. So it will look like it's doing it, but the process is still running. Just a quick look at the inline. There's also an example in the book. Just briefly, you insert the jump in the beginning of a function, and in this case, the setw device IO control file, which is a function that gets you the network information. And if the example inserts a hook that divert the execution to a malicious code, and it actually removes, the malicious code will remove traces of 443 HTTPS traffic before it returns to the function. So it actually will list the information that the process asked for, but of course when you remove traces of 443, that won't show up. And why would they do this? Well, to hide command and control communication over 443. So if you establish the command and control channel over HTTPS and you don't want this function to reveal that communication to any process, then this will wipe the evidence. That was chapter 11. Everything crystal clear and no questions? Read it yourself, but that goes without saying. Then I quickly just move over to chapter 12. Maybe by the end of the semester I'll learn how to move this mouse around too. That will be, there we go. This is not as long, so we should have plenty of time. No questions from Birger? No. Chapter 12, covert malware launching. Okay, hold on a second. See too. So, covert launching. We're going to look at a couple of the methods. So the idea here is that the malware, of course, does not want to be detected. That goes without saying. But so we're going to look at some methods that can be used to avoid detection. And like manipulating live memory on the system. This is used in techniques like DLL injection, process replacement, and hook injections, all terms that we already, well, you've heard them before in chapter 11, but we'll look a little bit more at them here. And also it can be done by modifying binaries on disk. That will be covered very briefly. But your goal here is then to, as always, to recognize the code construct that implements this, so that you're able to identify different ways that malware is launched. And as before, launchers only do one thing, they get the malware running. So if you detect this, then you know malware is running, but you don't know what it's doing. So you still have to use all the techniques that that we covered previously to dig deeper into what is it actually doing. But it could be a nice way of starting to say, hey, this something has started here that is running something somewhere in my system. I need to investigate. So let's look at the process injection first. By far the most popular launching technique, at least when this book was made, and I think that still holds. This is about getting your code into a process that is already running so that this process can do the job for you and execute the code without knowing it. So you can do this to conceal the malicious behavior. You can bypass security mechanisms by pretending you're a different program. There are some IOCs to look for. If I now can get this mouse working, here you go. Virtual alloc EX is used to allocate space in an external process memory. If you want to insert malware into a process, you need to have some memory space to do it. This is the function that allocates that space. So look for this. And then you need to fill that space with some data, and you do that with write process memory. So these two should tell you somebody reserved space somewhere, and they wrote something in there. Then I will be paranoid or suspicious and find out what is it. Question online, Björg is, you're confused, huh? Where is the boundary between process injection and process hallowing? The short answer to that, Björg, is I don't know, because I don't know how you defined the term process hallowing, as that is, if I remember correctly, it's not covered by the book, and that's the... the difficult thing here. It can be something completely different, or it could be that somebody else calls it process hallowing but means the same thing as process injection, or they mean a variant of it, or so I can't really answer that unless I see how process hallowing is defined. So sorry, I can't give you a better answer. I guess the answer is you have to look it up yourself. I can do a quick search too, see if I figure it out. But it is a bit of a challenge that there is not one correct way of labeling things in this field. So you will end up with that problem more than once. All right, what were we? Process injection. Yeah, look for these two functions. DLL injection, forcing a process to load a malicious DLL, commonly used loading technique, and you inject the code into the remote process that calls load library. When you load DLLs, the operating system will automatically call the DLL main function. So a piece of code in the beginning of the DLL. So if the malware writers write some malicious code in the beginning of this fake DLL, it might not even contain anything but that, but if they do that, they can then get their code executed, and you get the privileges of the process that called it. And of course, the whole idea here is that the process that loaded the DLL will get blamed, because it looks like it's that process that is doing that. It's a figure that tries to illustrate this. So you online can see too. See if I can get this mouse working. So you have some malware, launcher malware, that wants to go on the internet. Can't do that on its own. So it has a malicious DLL that it makes Internet Explorer. When you start up Internet Explorer, so it's loaded into memory, it injects this malicious DLL in here, and that gives this this launcher the ability to use to access internet using Internet Explorer. So it looks like it's the Internet Explorer that goes out, even though it's is this malware. And who would suspect Internet Explorer? That goes on the internet all the time. So then we have something called direct injection, which also needs to allocate space and insert code into the memory space or whatever is running. But it, instead of doing it in the DLLs that the process is loading, it inserts the code directly into the process. This is of course flexible. You can do much more, but it also you have to be careful because it it's a lot more chances that you can crash or impact the host process in a negative way, so that it's detected. This method is often used to insert something called shellcode. So you when you're analyzing this, you might have to resolve or analyze shellcode. That is covered in chapter 19 if you want to learn more about it. I'm not sure we will get that far in this class, but it's there if you need to study it. And it also to analyze this type of attack, it also in order to get to the shellcode or the malicious code, you might run let's say all a debug or do debugging like Sergey taught you, and then get to a certain point and then do a memory dump to see what you can find there, and then do the shellcode analysis. There are three functions commonly found in direct injection that you could look for. The two top ones you've seen before, virtual alloc and write process. It's used one time so you can reserve memory space and write data that you need to use in a remote thread that you're going to start up. And then you use it one more time to allocate space for and write the code, the remote thread code, into the process. And then you use the function create remote thread, and with the remote thread code that you inserted here and the data that you inserted here as parameters, and then you're good to go. So if you're gonna if you see these two, write alloc and write process memory, being used in pairs twice, and then a call to remote thread, then think direct injection. Process replacement. Not much left now, then we're done with chapter 12. This is a quick run through. In process replacement, you're not inserting your code, but you're overwriting the memory space of the running process. And this, of course, you can disguise as a legitimate process, but you're need to be careful that what you're overwriting isn't something essential that the that will be detected. And then it's claimed that this reduces the risk of crash compared to inserting into a process and let the process itself function. And again, you get the same privileges. And as an example, if you see svchost.exe running from Windows System 32 folder, will you suspect anything, or will you think that's always there? Nothing new. So it's if they can pull that off, it's at least not easily detected by looking just at what's running on the system. Next topic: hook injection. This is the last I'll cover, by the way. and then we'll stop early, I see. This uses the hook that we have seen before, the set windows hook EX. This is designed to intercept messages that are coming that are destined for a certain application. And you can use this for several things, but one is that you can get the malicious code only to run when a certain thing, a certain condition is happening, so a certain message is passed. And you can also use it to get the particular DLL into the victim's memory space. Two types of Windows hooks, local hooks and remote. Local hooks is for internal hooks in a process, and the remote is to hook another process on the system. And as we have mentioned already, this is frequently used in keyloggers. So when a key is pressed and that signal goes to whatever process is being used, you can have use set windows hook to get your malware to get a notification that somebody pressed this key. That was really a quick run through of chapter 12. Hope that wasn't too quick. If it was, then ask questions or go and study. It's a short chapter, so before I go to I have one slide on the lab, and then I'm done. But any questions? I must be really good at explaining this. Oh, you all read the chapter before you came here. Or you're so confused that you don't know what to ask. All right. Thumbs up from Bjørge. Perfect. Last slide then. As usual, there are labs after chapter 11 and 12. Please have a look at them. I know you're probably busy with other classes too, but this is a class that really, really requires hands-on. It's not enough to listen to me. And now I get your attention because it says exam tips up here. Then everybody's paying attention. I just want to mention that when we're coming to the exam, any questions that you find in the labs, I will look at that and see if I can create similar questions, of course. But as an example, one of the questions now in lab 11.1, question 2 is, how does the malware achieve persistence? That is one question you can get, or that style of question. But what you need to do is also practice and see if you're able to answer the following two variations. At what memory location do you find the function that achieves persistence? I can guarantee you, yes, I can guarantee you that you will get a question with that style on the exam. I will give you some function. It could be persistence, it could be encryption, it could be command and control, it could be anything that we covered. I want you to be able to find out where in the binary is that implemented and give me the memory location. And then I will flip it around and give you the memory location somewhere in malware, and I will ask you what happens here. Tell me what this piece of code is doing right here. And the answer could be, it achieves persistence, or something else. So keep this in mind when you read and study, then you'll do fine, I hope. Not all questions will be like that, but that will definitely be in there too. So, all right. I think Sergei will be here 10:15. Today I will have to leave from 10 till 11, but I will be back at 11 to see if any question or you have any questions. But until 11, you're in Sergei's hands, and I'll see if he can log on, be online, Bjørge, and if not, I'll be back online at 11. Okay. Any last minute things? Okay, from online classroom, no. Then I went overtime last time, and then you get 10 minutes back today, so we're even. Thank you.